Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the weekly podcast by Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. This week, Kazakhstan's interim president, Kasym Jomart Tokayev, said that his country repatriated 231 Kazakh citizens from Syria. And a week earlier, Tajik authorities announced the return of 84 minors who were born to ISIS fighters of Tajik origin in Syria and in Iraq. These people are some of 4,000 Central Asians who earlier went to Syria to join ISIS. It is unclear as to how many of them are still in Syria and still alive. But the pressing question of today is, as ISIS continues to crumble, how the Central Asian countries are coping with the situation involving their citizens in the Middle East who was once with the ISIS. To discuss this question, I'm joined by Kinishbek Sainizarov, Central Asia Program Director at Search for Common Ground. Asal Murza Kuluba is joining us from Bishkek. She is a research fellow at the University of Central Asia. Salim John Ayubov, Acting Director of RFRL's Tajik Service, and Bruce Panier, Editor of RFRL's Central Asia Blog, Kishlak Owazi. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very, very nice to have you. Okay, let's start with the latest development. So there are a number of issues that we would like to talk about. First, the question of repatriation. I guess the latest news is from Kazakhstan, where the last week 231 Kazakh citizens were brought back. So what else do we know about these people, the people who were brought back? Who wants to take this question? Kinesh, Asel, Bruce, feel free.
You mentioned news from Kazakhstan, but you also can see that from Kyrgyzstan, you can hear very positive news. Here we can see that regional response for repatriation was quite different. If Kazakhstan and Tajikistan put a lot of efforts to bring children come back to the home, in Kyrgyzstan, we not seeing such efforts from the government. I can say that we can see the political will here. And also we can see that in Kyrgyzstan, a lot of social discussions among the civil society and also different groups about what we can expect actually. And maybe some part of the society not support actual repatriation policy.
Mm-hmm.
We can see that in Kazakhstan or in Tajikistan, also some discussion was raised, but mostly public opinion was not so against this.
Asal, you are touching really an important issue here. We are going to talk about the causes of this, but I just wanted to start with this news first. Maybe, Bruce, you can take this. We had some pieces published on our website about the people who were brought back in Kazakhstan. I was reading news about the response by the Kazakhstan's Deputy Foreign Minister, Yerzhan Ashikbayev. He sounded like these people were evacuated from Syria as a result of some sort of operation, and a number of them were arrested. So I was kind of curious, who are the people who were brought back and who are eligible to be brought back and who are not? How these things are determined?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't have all the answers to that. Certainly, you mentioned there was 231 people. I think the bulk of them were women and children. Mm. You know, there were some men, and two of them ended up being arrested once they got back. But, you know, I mean, it's a difficult process. These people have either been taken by local security forces and brought to some kind of internment area. In this case, that seems to be pretty much what happened, is these people all essentially gave themselves up to local authorities. And you know, although Kazakh and Tajik and other officials have been involved in this, you know, I think a lot of this is done through either Russia or Turkey, but especially Russia. I mean, you know, like Kadyrov from Chechnya seems to play a pretty big role, certainly in the Kazakh case, of trying to repatriate these people. The first Kazakhs that were brought home, the first children that were brought out of the Middle East and brought back to Kazakhstan, it was all because of Kadyrov's intervention. So there's a lot of different governments involved in this. Now, most of these people are not combatants. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, they're, for the most part, they're women and children. They were there because their husbands were there or they had gone with their husbands. Now, obviously, if you were a fighter out there in the Middle East, then you're probably not going to be as welcome at home, hence the two arrests in Kazakhstan. So these aren't the kind of people that are probably giving themselves up or unless they were captured because they know what's going to happen to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Salim John, let's talk about Tajikistan a little bit. A week earlier, Tajikistan repatriated 84 minors of ISIS fighters of Tajik domestic citizens. I guess their parents are still in Syria, dead or in jail. But what do we know about these people, about these kids?
Thank you, Mohammed. We know that fathers of those kids either killed or lost in Iraq. However, their mothers are in the jail, and they sentenced to the long-term prison. And additionally, there is 11 more kids in Iraqi jail, but mothers do not allow them to bring back. And so it was done by the Tajik authorities in a very good manner, and people in Tajikistan praised the government, and especially the Tajik ambassador to Kuwait, Mr. Zubayd Zoda, and also some Iraqi NGOs. And Mr. Ambassador have been working with them closely, first to define where those citizens are, and second, how to bring them back. However, going back to your question about that, how they define who could be repatriated or not, I should say that maybe Tajikistan was a pioneer in the region about defining his approach towards fighters in Iraq and Syria.
Right.
In 2014, for the first time, The regional prosecutor of this SOGD region said that we should think about how to help those people to return to Tajikistan. And he proposed that to get a soft approach if those people will come back voluntarily, and if they didn't take part in fightings and are not responsible for killings or things like this. And later on, the parliament also discussed so the legal framework of this was not ready yet, and the parliament proposed to amend the criminal code, and they amended it. And after that, 120 Tajik citizens either came back by their own wish or helped by the government and by others, government, by NGOs, to return home. And from them, what we know, 36 of them were released upon arrival. However, we don't know the fate of 34 remained. Either they are in the prison or what happened to them, we don't know. Overall, Tajikistan succeeded in bringing back home more than 200 people, young people, who joined ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
How long they have been doing this, Selim John? I mean, we started hearing about activities of ambassador. I think he's very much passionate about that. Usually, Central Asian diplomats are not as proactive as he seemed to be. What I'm saying is, how long Tajikistan has been doing this?
I think this process started in 2015 when the legal framework was ready. And I should say about the ambassador, he was former chief of the protocol of the President Rahmon. And probably it gave him more power, more independence to deal with that. And also as a former scholar on Arabic issues, he had very nice relationship with the many Arab prominent figures in Arab world, and probably those ties also somehow helped him to accomplish that.
Yeah, all these cultural understanding of the region also helped him to navigate, you know, his way. Bruce, I think the number of people were also arrested in Kazakhstan when they were repatriated, right? I don't know how long Kazakhstan has been doing this.
It's been a couple of years now, but they've come out in small groups prior to this. I mean, the 231 was just, by anyone's standards in Central Asia, that was the largest group that was taken out at one time. But they've got 8 here, 10 there, and that's been going on for a while. And like I said, that was largely coming out of Syria. And that was, of course, you know, because Russia has military forces on the ground. So, you know, that's why I said that Russia plays a part in this, too, because they have troops and transport planes on the ground. And so they brought these people out, and a lot of them end up in Russia first before they get back to Kazakhstan. You know, I don't know what the total figure is, because like I said, it's been kind of piecemeal. A few here, a few the next month, you know, and 2 months later, 8 or 9 more. But it's been ongoing for at least a couple of years now.
Yeah, and we also don't know how many still are in the Middle East. But anyway, so Asil, I don't hear anything from Kyrgyzstan. Earlier, we were talking about 70% of ISIS fighters from Kyrgyzstan having gone to Syria from one small town in the south, which must make it rather easier, one would think, to identify those individuals. So what the authorities are doing or have been doing about its citizens in Syria so far, like, you know, in the examples of Tajikistan and Kazakhstan?
Generally, they say that they will try to return or repatriate.
Did they do?
But
did,
in fact,
yeah, did,
yeah.
Did they repatriate anyone so far?
See any, any concrete steps to this. And I think it's also open a big question about legitimization, because we can say that this act, it's very symbolic when the authorities take children from a zone of war. And I think this very symbolically powerful decision.
Mm-hmm.
So it can also work to the legitimization of authorities, and of course for the risk minimization in the future.
Yeah, that's what the Tajik authorities were saying that. But in terms of numbers, Asel, how many people so far Kyrgyzstan brought back from Syria? Is there any number that we can talk about?
We can say that it wasn't some special operation like was in Kazakhstan and Tajikistan. It's only case-by-case numbers.
Okay, let's see. Now, talking about the Uzbekistan, Bruce, I think we were talking about this a little bit earlier. So what are they doing about their citizens? I think, you know, the Uzbeks make up, I believe, the largest number of fighters who went to Syria from Central Asia, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. But I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that all those Uzbeks came from Uzbekistan. Mm. But yes, they probably are the biggest single group, which is not surprising since there's more Uzbeks in Central Asia than there is anybody else. You know, but I mean, the Uzbek government and the Turkmen government, too, have taken a much different approach to this. They don't want these people back at all. You know, now, Mirziyoyev, I'm not really sure what exactly his policy is on this. I haven't seen him articulate it. But when Karimov was alive, there was no way these people were going to be brought back at the expense of the Uzbek government. And in any case, I doubt any one of them would have wanted to go there. You know, Uzbekistan has been locked. The airports, they're looking for these people at all the airports in Uzbekistan when international flights arrive. And anyone, especially if you're a young man, anywhere between 18 and 40 years old, when you arrive, you're going to have to talk to the security forces that were at the airport. And they have a lot of questions about where you've been, who you've been with. And if there's any doubt at all about the story that these people tell, then they're going to be detained until either Uzbek authorities are satisfied that they weren't doing anything wrong, or until they have sufficient reason to believe that these people were involved in some of this stuff, in which case they are detained indefinitely. And that's what happened to a lot of them. So I think the words got out. It's pretty much the same situation in Turkmenistan. Yeah. These people are screened at the airport. If they have reason to believe that you were part of this, they're going to lock you up right away.
Yeah, but what explains the state policies there, like both in these countries, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, that they apparently have no interest in those people in terms of bringing them back? What explains their policies, Kanishbek?
Well, it's largely explains that there is no policy on it. Within the security forces, there are, what I see, there are two camps. Ones who think that one way or the other, these people, if especially the kids and women, should be repatriated.
Right.
But then, as the other speaker said, there is another camp of the thought that they believe that, well, these people have left the country with their own will, and why should the government make an extra effort to bring them back? So, you know, and at the same time, I think the larger issue, like in the case of, let's say, in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, there is, unlike Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, the criminal code and the legal framework has not been revisited. To what extent this, if that happens with the citizens of Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan, how the states will bring them to the, treat them within the parameters of rule of law.
Yeah, but if we think in those terms, I mean, Tajikistan, where things are rapidly deteriorating on all fronts, human rights, democracy, and is proactively setting an example, as Salim John said, by trying to own this process from a long time already, and where some democratic-leaning countries, I should say, like Kyrgyzstan and recently Uzbekistan, they are taking backseat. I mean, it's a kind of interesting situation, and just
I think it's not only Kyrgyzstan or Uzbekistan. If we see UK response, also very restrictive, I will say, and some European countries too. I mean, it's no direct correlation between democracy and political will in such case, I think.
Bruce, is it the way you see it?
No, I mean, absolutely. We just had the case of this one in the UK. There was the case of the one young woman who left with her friends to go. And there was a significant portion of the public. It was that February, I guess, when they finally caught her. And she wanted to come back because she was pregnant or either just had a child. I can't remember. And there was a big portion of the British population that did not want her to come back, and they revoked her citizenship so she couldn't. So yes, I mean, it's not so much a question of whether your government is democratic or not. It's kind of
then what explains this?
You know, like I said, it matters how strongly the public opinion is against this, and to some extent, I suppose governments play a role in that by using state media. But, you know, there's even in the United States, I don't think, as far as I know, there is no policy to repatriate.
Is it
people that have been?
Is the public opinion dictates these policies in Central Asia? And I just kind of wonder. Right?
Like I said, the governments do the policy, but and everyone kind of goes along with what they do. Let's be real about this. It's kind of harsh to, especially in Central Asia, they have great respect for the families and stuff. Now, if the husband decided to go and fight there and took his wife and children, and maybe more children were born when he was there, most people aren't going to blame the wife and the children for this bad decision. So it's a little bit different than in the West, where a lot of these people, you know, especially the women, have gone on their own free will by themselves with other friends.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of the people from Central Asia, the women and children that found themselves there because the head of the household, the husband, father, took them to these places.
Yeah. Salim John, I think you mentioned this a little bit later. Okay, now you have Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan kind of taking a different avenue on this. Tajikistan is kind of actively trying to bring them back alongside Kazakhstan. Why Tajikistan is doing this? I mean, what is that they are motivated by?
Even without this question, I was intended to add something to bring more colors and the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Because it shouldn't be thought like this, that Tajikistan is every day just those statements, sitting and thinking how to bring them back. Of course, no. And there is a lot of opposition inside of the government, inside of the parliament, and in the public opinion also. For example, We have receiving a lot of comments that, no, we don't want those people come back. Why we need them here? They could bring those destabilities that they have seen in the Middle East and things like this. However, I think, as I mentioned it, in July 2014, it was a kind of testing the problem and seeing that is it possible by this soft approach to prevent young people to go there? Of course, and some people in the government acknowledged that since the very weak Islamic education in the country, those young people have been brainwashed in Russia mostly and traveled to Middle East from Russia, not from Tajikistan directly. And when they tried this way and have seen that it helps, so there was more support for this way, and then they have been able to change the legal framework. And in 2016 only, they succeeded in bringing back 120 of citizens, and also many others returned from halfway to Middle East, you know, since they understood one thing, that if those people will think there is no way back, so they will continue and they will stay. And of course, they will becoming more dangerous and dangerous. So Again, as I said, we don't know, at least from those who came back in 2015, 70 young men, 36 of them has been released, but we don't know anything about the fate of 34 others. So probably they're in jail. And it shows that the government approach was kind of different or selective or individually against any person who has been in Middle East.
Okay. Now that the
Mohammed, may I please add a couple of points? Since one is since the involvement of Russian government has been mentioned several times, and I think for the fairness perspective, I think we should also not forget that the U.S. and Syrian democratic groups have also facilitated the repatriation of some of the people, especially for those citizens of Kazakhstan. So it's not only the Russia who's doing this kind of effort. And the second view, which I happen to talk with the analytics from all Central Asian countries, is that especially from Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, some of them, they believe that, you know, it is the government tries to claim this as one of the efforts of neutralizing the ultimate threat to the security and peace in the country, because, you know, all these individuals have left the country by their own will and joining the ISIS groups. But for the Kazakh and Tajik governments, they are still the citizens of Tajikistan and Kazakhstan. Right. And with that, the repatriation and reintegration programs, they would still make an effort, more civil way of approaching this perceived threat, especially when it comes to women and kids.
Right.
And I think this is also a fair point.
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk about that a little bit now. Now that the citizens who are repatriated, so what happens when those individuals brought back? How the state treat them? What's the reaction they get from the society? And what future holds for them with the ISIS stamp in their background? Let's continue Majlis podcast talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis, I'm joined by Keneshbek Sainazarov, Central Asia Program Director at the Search for Common Ground, Asil Mirza Kulubar, Research Fellow at the University of Central Asia, Salim John Ayubov, Acting Director of RFRL's Tajik Service, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia Blog, Kishlak Owaziyai, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing the repatriation of ISIS fighters of Central Asian origin from the Middle East. Okay, so let's talk about Tajikistan first again, Salim John. It's kind of unique case. So once those minors were brought back 2 weeks ago, I understand most of their parents, as you said, are still in Syria or already dead. So what is next for those kids in Tajikistan? And what are some of the common challenges to reintegrate them to the society? I guess many of them even doesn't speak Tajik or Russian language anymore.
Yes, you are right. Many of them do not speak Tajik at all. The first thing is that, which I liked very much, the authorities from the very beginning at the airport told all the journalists that please do not show their faces on your reports. And then all those people went through the medical checkup, and afterwards they been transferred to the very nice place resort on a mountainous area in Varzov Valley, and they are under the supervision of the psychologist, of the doctors, and so on. And people asking to adopt those kids, to help, some sending toys and the money and food, and so just showing their empathy. So everyone knew that they are innocent, because some of them even born in Iraqi jails on Iraqi soil. So, however, if we should talk about foreign fighters themselves, as I said, we can divide them into three groups. The first group who has been accepted very nice and who understood the whole problem and themselves try to rehabilitate and reintegrate to the society. So the government helped them to become a kind of agitation group, or how to say, agit brigada, as in former Soviet Union. And they traveled around the country, meeting young people and telling what they have seen in Syria or Iraq. So this is one group. And reintegration for the people of this group was very easy, it's looking like. The second part is the biggest part. We don't know the details. They just went to their villages, on to their places, or some of them returned to Russia, continuing of being labor migrants. And we don't know for sure that if they understood, if they have any remorse about what have done with their own lives. So, but a smaller group, maybe dozens or less, under permanent surveillance of the security services, because maybe they have some kind of information and they always are looking after them and seeing what they have been doing. And probably they have a kind of schedule just to come to the security service representatives to show up and to sign some papers. I don't know. So, but those three groupings, so we learned as a reporting about those who returned to the country.
Kenishbek, what's your insight into how Kazakhstan is handling its citizens who were repatriated from Syria? Is it any different from what Tajikistan is doing?
Yeah, it is very much different. In Kazakhstan, everyone who has been brought back from Middle East were directly taken to the Special Center for Integration, which is located in Aktau. And all of those individuals are going through, at the moment, through the psychosocial reintegration program. And, you know, we can take an example. Like, I think the Kazakh government, or the Kazakhstan, has taken quite a professional approach in it. Because they intake everyone and then sort out those who already have some links to the extremist organizations, like in the example of just a recent repatriation case, 16 men, 59 women, and 156 kids were brought back. And immediately 16 men and 4 women were taken for the suspicion of being members of the ISIS. And the other group has gone into the reintegration center in Aktau, and they're going through that treatment. And in Samarkand, I had a considerable amount of time with the two ladies who have been working in with those individuals in the last 3-4 months. And according to them, both of them are the psychologists. And they believe that according to the program the Kazakh government has put in place, it will take at least 6 to 9 months before they can firmly say that these individuals are kind of ready to go back to their own communities. Otherwise, they will have to stay in that special reintegration camp, or the center, we call, and go through that treatment. And there is no word so far in Kazakhstan when and how those individuals will be released from that special camp or the center.
Wow, okay. Asil, children is a kind of a different case here. Talking about adults, the type of people that Kenishbek was talking about, given their background, being in Syria and being part of this terrorist organization, so what are some of the common challenges do you see these citizens face in their reintegration to the society, even though if they are vetted and released?
Of course, they will stigmatized hardly in their communities. And we can say from experience which we had in the frame of Not In Our Name project, that a lot of community members not wanna have any deal with families who has members who left to Syria or who come back from Syria, so they hardly stigmatized. And I will say that integration is a very delicate process. And of course, tactically, we can now talk about this reintegration camps, different approach, but strategically, I think integration issue will depend from a much broader perspective, what kind of religious policy will be in these countries. I mean, of course, we can say that if de-radicalization, how this term used for repatriants, I mean, if they will go through these programs, but when they continue their life in communities and in society where religious policy will not have a change, I mean, then I can say we still have risks.
Yeah.
And not only with these people, but generally, because I think this situation generally gives a lot of understanding that religious policy should be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter what kind of psychologists will work with in these camps and what kind of efforts will go through the government. But if general context will not change, I think still we have the same challenge.
You know, you brought us to a really nice place, Asel. So Asel was talking about, Bruce, the underlying cause. I mean, it's good that Tajikistan has some sort of integration program, and as well as Kazakhstan, for those who are brought back. But what are the other lessons that the authorities learned from this entire process? So what would you say, whether they learned anything from it?
Whether they learned anything from it, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
You know, Asel, you know, her research and the group that did the Not In Our Name documentaries, you know, I mean, they kind of showed that it's going to change from place to place. Now, the socioeconomic conditions in the places they're from played a role in a lot of these people deciding to go. There simply wasn't anything, no employment at home, no opportunities on the horizon, you know. And, of course, we've heard, you know, and Kenish mentioned that a lot of people, and Selim John mentioned that some people had gone to Russia for work, and it had happened there. But again, this comes back home, you know, to the fact that there wasn't those kind of job opportunities there. Some Central Asian officials, and it changes from country to country, but have suggested that, you know, that what Asel just said about religion is that, that part of the problem was that there isn't enough religious education in some of these countries, really in any of the Central Asian countries. So, you know, these people, young people, could get lured in because they didn't have sufficient knowledge of the Quran to understand that what they were being told really didn't have anything to do with the Quran. You know, now, trying to open the door on that is going to be a tough challenge, certainly in the near term, to say that what we need is more religious education in the country, because if anything, we've seen that that madrasas are under suspicion and pretty much across Central Asia. So it's kind of a tough balancing act to say that a lack of religious knowledge helped lure these people in, but we're not really willing to provide our society with greater religious knowledge at the same time.
Okay.
Mohammed, can I make one last point before we go off? I'm sorry. I think the case with Kazakhstan is very interesting so far, and I think we should continue observing what it will happen and how those individuals either will be released or not released. But the interesting one is the case with Russia, because Russia was one of the first countries who had repatriated its citizens from the war zones. But then it has, after the first round of the repatriation, that program has been stopped. And the Russian FSB, the head of the FSB, Bortnikov, said that, you know, nonetheless, these individuals really put a real threat to the peace and security for the country. And somehow that program has stopped, and Russia hasn't been doing it since, I think, the last year. And my only guess is that I think the Russia brought them, all those individuals back, and they tried to put them through the reintegration and psychosocial treatment. But my guess is only that perhaps it didn't really take them too far. And so it's quite interesting now, I think, in relation to that, to observe what will happen with those individuals, the Kazakhstan and Tajikistan border.
Okay, terrific. Thank you very much. I think we really need to end the discussion, but just very final point. Let me take, Asel, you have been a little bit quiet today. So talking about, again, lessons learned from it. So if there was one example of lesson learned in Central Asia, what is that, and whether it can be copied by some other Central Asian countries to address this issue?
I can say that we found a lot of diversity. Sometimes when we made an analysis on regional level, we go to this generalization. But even in one country, for example, Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, you can see so different specifics. We haven't know only one answer, for example, what is a push factor or drivers which push people. And in this regard, I think we need to analyze more complexly this problem and not give very simplistic answer like it is poverty, like it is no job, or it is lack of justice, or it's some no of political dialogue, etc. It's very complex issue which require really complex answer. And this answer shouldn't come only through state. Actually, what I want to point that the first repatriation action was made by families. During our project, we found several families which sent their members to repatriate their members. So it was the fathers, mothers who left their children in this war. So I think that this is a very remarkable case, and they was the pioneers who made the repatriation possible.
I believe we have many other questions to discuss in this topic, but for today, let's end it here. So thank you very much, Asel Mirzakulova, Research Fellow at the University of Central Asia. Asel was also part of the Radio Free Europe Liberties team, which did the Not in Our Name, which is a counter-extremism project on Central Asia. Thank you very much. And also, big thanks goes to Keneshvek Sainazarov, Central Asia Program Director at the Search for Common Ground, Salimjan Ayebov, Acting Director of Radio Free Europe, Free Europe Radio Liberties Tajik Service, Bruce Spanier, Editor of Radio Free Europe Radio Liberties Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you. Thank you very much, colleagues, for your time today.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.